Welcome to Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 1975 Stanley Kubrick film Barry Lyndon. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Barrett, I'm so excited to talk about this movie and to talk about. I have a very strange personal history with this movie, so I'm excited to talk about that. But let's start with your history. Is this something that you were aware of, that you saw in 75? Is this something you came across later?
I saw this in 75. I was so excited to see this because by that point I was a Kubrick fan. And I can picture the theater I saw it in Connecticut. And I can remember being really struck, this is going to sound silly, being really struck by intermission. I had never been in a film before that actually had an intermission. So I was curious. Actually, I know that I've seen it on DVD before, but I didn't remember. It been quite a long time. So I was interested to see that they included the intermission on the DVD as well. So,
do you remember your first impressions of this film?
I loved it. I loved it. I mean, I think... I was fine with the pace. You know, a lot of people talk about the film having a glacial pace. I just thought it was a film to kind of luxuriate in. And I think seeing it, especially on a big screen, I think that was one reason maybe why it had the impact it had, because it really is a big screen film.
Absolutely. So when we watched this this weekend, I watched it with my daughter and my wife, and they had never seen it before. So I made a point to say, we have to put the projector. We have to get the projector out and put this up on a bigger screen. It's not the same as a theater, but you know, at least we had like a 10-foot wide screen to watch it on, because this is a movie that looks amazing, and the look of the film is really important to it and something Kubrick was interested in. Now, I'm going to tell you my story of watching this because it is deeply strange. So it's July of 2004. I am in Arlen, Norway. Like way up north in the fjord area, like the upper fjord area of Norway, and I can't sleep. So I turn on the TV, and there is a movie on set seemingly in the 18th century. I find out, you know, years later, it's about a half hour into the movie, and I watch the middle 2 hours of this movie in the middle of the night, hoping I'm going to fall asleep, and instead I'm so captivated by what I'm watching. I don't know what it is, because there's not commercial breaks, it just plays. So I'm like, and I didn't know what Barry I didn't mean the name if hearing the name Barry Lyndon in the movie doesn't mean anything to me. And then I fell asleep with about a half hour left in the movie. So I saw in 2004 in the middle of the night in Norway the middle 2 hours of this movie, and I just was like, this is so interesting, because I didn't know who made it. I was like, this, but it felt like somebody had taken a 18th or 19th century novel and like accurately portrayed what it felt like to read one of those novels and put it on the screen. And I remember I would talk with people about this movie that I encountered in the middle of the night. I don't think I actually tracked down the movie and watched it until at the earliest 2018, but it's probably more like 2020 that I sat down and watched the movie and had the context of here is who Stanley Kubrick is and all these other pieces. So it was such a strange introduction to the movie. I didn't even know if it was in fact based on a book, or if this was, because I think I turned it on thinking like, oh, here's some sort of like Pride and Prejudice-y kind of thing. And like, it just, I turned it on because I thought I would fall asleep. And instead I was captivated in the middle of the night by this.
So, Sam, had you figured out later on what it was, or did you just happen to come to?
No, I figured it out because I had the name Barry Lyndon in my head.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, okay, well, this is clearly what this movie is, so I have to figure out. So I think I found out that it was, in fact, a book by Thackeray, and that it was a Kubrick movie, but I never sought it out. But one of the things that, as I think about that story, we have talked in the past about how much... David Lynch loves Stanley Kubrick, and how Kubrick liked Eraserhead.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that. It's like, huh, what do those have in common? And at least for me, what those two filmmakers have in common is they create objects of art that at times you're like, I'm not sure what it is about this, but I have to look at it. And when you get away from it, it stays in your head and you just kind of want to go back and be like, can I go back to that thing and like, experience that again? Because I think maybe in both of them there's this feeling like is there something more there? Even if you feel like it's great and there's so much to it, you're like, but maybe there's more. Maybe if I watch it again, I go back to this thing, and not like you're trying to solve a puzzle, but I'm trying to get back to an experience of watching. Mm-hmm. And they pay off on review. So that's my initial history with this movie.
Well, the other thing I'll say, because you know, if you entice me with David Lynch, I'm going to extend that for a minute, as you know, Sam. I think the other connection between those two filmmakers, and this may sound strange talking about a filmmaker, but I think some filmmakers are more visual than others. Mm. You know, Billy Wilder has been faulted sometimes for not having a very strong visual sense. I think that's wrong, but he's been faulted for that. But Lynch originally, fundamentally began his career as a painter. And Kubrick began his career as a still photographer. Mm. In fact, he was hired by Look magazine when he was 17 years old. And Kubrick loved it. He loved when he could to grab the camera. In fact, the handheld shots in Barry Lyndon were most likely shot by Kubrick himself. He just loved doing that. So I think maybe that's one thing they have in common is that they're both really, really strongly visual in their approach to storytelling.
You know, I knew both of those facts, but hadn't connected them of like visual artists who then become filmmakers. That is interesting.
Yeah.
So have you ever read Thackeray's Barry Lyndon?
No, but I've read enough about it this past week that I feel I have a pretty good handle on it. But you're probably going to tell me you did read it this weekend.
I did read it this weekend, Barrett, because you know me well. If I'm, especially if it's a movie that I've seen before, it's like I can squeeze in reading this book. And it's really interesting. Have you read other Thackeray? I don't really know about Thackeray.
I of course read Vanity Fair, which Kubrick actually considered adapting before he landed on Barry Lyndon. But Vanity Fair is just a really big Dickensian novel. Now, did you read the original Barry Lyndon, or did you read the 1852, 54, whatever?
I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look. I'm not sure
because
which
it
was.
It came out in the 1830s in serial form, and Thackeray created a commentator in the arc named Fitz something, but he eliminated him for the 1852 edition.
I read the original then.
Oh, good. Okay.
Because I had the editor in there, which I think is important.
Yes.
So it's interesting to both watch this movie and read this book within the same 36 hour span of time. Because I actually was able to compare them and think about this. I am fascinated. One of my favorite subjects that we've come back to again and again is thinking about Kubrick and literary adaptation. Because if you think about it, almost, and it may be everything he does, but at least almost everything he does is a literary adaptation of sorts. I mean, the loosest one being Strangelove, which is based on this book, but not really. But at least there, it has a credited, like, this was the launching off point. But a lot of what he does is actually saying, I'm going to take this interesting novel, whether it's Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, or whether it's The Shining, or Trom Novel, or whatever. Like, and what's, I have put myself to the task of reading the source material for a lot of Kubrick movies. One of the things I'm fascinated by is, for the most part, he really actually is, I think, more faithful to those works than people think. If you haven't read it, you assume like, oh, I'm sure he took this and didn't really like base a lot of it on the source material. But it's surprising. This Christmas, for various reasons, I read The Short Timers, which Full Metal Jacket is based on, and I was shocked how much of Kubrick's movie is that novel. Like, I assumed he took little pieces and made his own thing, but he actually often will lean fairly heavily on the source material, which is kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you brought that up, Sam, because I think as far as I know, only his first two films, Fear and Desire, which he disowned, tried to have it destroyed, and Killer's Kiss, they're not based, as far as I know, on any literary predecessor. But beginning with The Killing and going forward, you're right, they're all adaptations. 2001's a little funny, though, because it's
they wrote it at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's based loosely on The Sentinel and the short story, and then they developed the novel. But Kubrick said about himself, you know, Kubrick had a good ego, but he was also honest, and he said, I just don't have... That's just not a creative gift that I have to make an original story. So yeah, he always almost always adapts.
I'm sure there are schools where you can take a course on Kubrick and literary adaptation. It would be fascinating because everyone he does a little differently too, though. Like it's you're getting that author and their voice, but also as shot through the lens of and read through the mind of Stanley Kubrick. I think that's it's really actually fun to do. Listeners, I would recommend if there's a Kubrick movie you love, go seek out the source material because you get a little snapshot into his head of processing a piece of art and saying yes and or yes but or yes also, and it's I love it.
And what I like about it too is that his taste is eclectic. He doesn't just adapt highbrow stuff. I mean, so you've got the Shining, which is kind of occupies one place, and then you have the Short Timers, and then you have Arthur Schnitzler or Anthony Burgess. He'll just draw from anywhere, and the soundtracks of his films are similar as well. I mean, you get everything from classical to popular music. So whatever he thinks works is what he's going. He's like a magpie. Whatever he thinks works, he's going to steal.
And here's my takeaways from looking at the novel and thinking about this. The arc of the novel and the film follow a similar trajectory. Definitely it shares the tone of the world that Thackeray lays out. The big shift in perspective, as you talked about, is the narrator, where Barry's the narrator of the novel. But what's interesting is because Thackeray has this editor who occasionally pops in to correct Barry or to speak more sort of voice of Gotti over top of Barry. Mm-hmm. 'Cause Barry's not not the most reliable of narrators. Right. It's like what Kubrick does to say, okay, for my film, I'm going to take that editorial voice and I'm just going to stretch it over the whole film and say, that's my voiceover instead of having any Barry voiceover. And apparently this is something Ryan O'Neill hated about the movie. He hated he hated that it wasn't Barry's point of view. And there must've been a moment where he assumed he was going to read narration for this movie because when he saw it, he was really upset and kind of hates this film because of it. And I think part of it is a kind of a misread of Barry Lyndon, or at least what Kubrick wanted to do with Barry Lyndon.
But at the same time, my understanding was that at least initially, O'Neill was hoping this is the film that would kind of raise his stature as a serious actor, right? Mm-hmm. We saw him previously a while ago. We saw him in Paper Moon. And of course, right before Barry Lyndon, he was in What's Up, Doc? And one other light comedy. I can't remember which one. But anyway, so he didn't have a reputation as any kind of a heavyweight actor. And I think he thought his association with this film would help raise his stock in that respect.
So generally speaking, I think sort of events and people change, but they're sort of different means to the same end. Now, the biggest difference other than the perspective shift is that the novel does not have the final pistol duel with Bullingdon.
Or the first one. His father in the novel doesn't die in a
pistol. Right. Yes.
And that's important. Yeah. And I just make that point, Sam, because I think it's part of Kubrick's bookending. Anyway. Yeah.
Yes. No. You're absolutely right. But it still has the Kubrick has a bookending of Barry is in a duel, which seems has the potential that this is staged against him, and then the people around him are just trying to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. He's pushed out of Ireland in that way, or pushed out of at least where he lives in Ireland, and then is pushed back to Ireland at the end of the film.
Yes.
You know, with that same setup. So the Bullingdon duel, which is a fairly significant scene in thinking about what you make of this movie, is a Kubrick creation. That scene in the way that sets up, and the role that Bullingdon plays because of that is definitely heightened by Kubrick with that. Why do you think you wanted to make this film? Because this comes after Kubrick has this run of three films that you could think of thematically as like about humanity and technology in different ways. I mean, they're about lots of things, but if you wanted to say Strangelove 2001 and A Clockwork Orange, that is a theme in those, it definitely is, you know, and maybe humanity's capability of destroying itself is definitely a theme running through those. Yeah, they're all, at least 2001 and A Clockwork Orange have a very like set in the near or distant future. This is then all of a sudden he does this period piece, which he hadn't really done something like that before. I mean, the closest thing, I guess, Spartacus, but that's kind of a Kubrick movie, right?
Wasn't really his movie.
Yeah. You know, otherwise, like the farthest back he goes, I think, is World War One. But now all of a sudden we're going back further. So what do you think drew him to this material?
Well, I think I guess maybe this is begging the question, Sam, to say that he made Barry Lyndon because he couldn't make Napoleon. So maybe the question is, you know, what interested him about Napoleon? And so I think what interests him about Napoleon is the figure of Napoleon. So he had done, I mean, the script exists. In fact, I heard a commentator the other day say that Ridley Scott would have done well to film Kubrick's script of Napoleon rather than what he did film. So you know, typical Kubrick fashion, he did all the research. He employed research assistants to do the background on Napoleon. He had everything prepared for a Napoleonic epic, and then he couldn't get it produced because Sergei Bondarchuk, the Russian director, had done a film of Waterloo a couple of years in 1970 that was a big flop. So nobody wanted to finance another Napoleonic era film. So Kubrick, evidently, I think, this is my speculation, I think because of that interest in Napoleon and all the location scouting that he'd done and all the preparation he'd done, I guess he thought, well, I really got my mind set on a historical epic, and that's what I want to do. So that's what he did. And then also in terms of what you were saying, Sam, you know, it's like, okay, I've spent some time looking ahead. Let's then spend some time looking back. And I think the other thing that Kubrick was conscious of was he was trying to save money. And so by doing only location shooting, there's no studio shooting in this film at all. By doing only location shooting, he was actually saving quite a bit of money. So again, doing historical epic like this was really, there's lots of places you can shoot in England, Ireland, and on the continent.
So besides the sort of time period settings, are there any other connections you think to think about why Kubrick wanted to make a Napoleon movie and why he wants to make a Barry Lyndon movie? Because like those seem like, it's like, if you think about the character of those people, are those, do you find similarities in those, or is this a similar setting, different tale?
Well, I find similar interests, right? I mean, one of the themes in Kubrick, and this is sometimes mediated by technology, one of the themes, and we talked about this when we talked about 2001 and Strangelove, is that there's this element of human error, human fallibility, that no matter what human beings do, things will always go wrong. And Kubrick is really interested in the kind of forces that cause human beings to fail. And sometimes those forces are social, sometimes they're natural, sometimes they're psychological. So, and I'm just playing a psychologist here, right? So Napoleon is interesting as the kind of this kind of this Ubermensch, almost this Superman figure, you know, who imposes his will upon Europe and ultimately falls. And I will say that the last date you see in Barry Lyndon is 1789, which is obviously the French Revolution, but it's also, that's when Napoleon, you know, begins his rise. So I think Kubrick was fascinated by the idea of this guy, of a character like this, who can be, you know, kind of a world historical figure, as they used to say. Now, Barry is, of course, not a world historical figure by any stretch of the imagination, but he's also a character. Think about how often in this film the narrator talks about fate, or the narrator talks about, you know, despite Barry's intentions, here's what goes wrong. And so I think Kubrick is interested in that much smaller scale than Napoleon, but I think still some of the same concerns, like what can an individual do by the force of his own will and creativity to rise through the world? And in the case of Barry Lyndon, it's the opposition of society that he's facing.
And I want to definitely unpack those things when we get into themes of this movie, because I think there's lots of potential themes, and I'm I've seen this movie a few times, but I'm definitely no expert on it. So there's things where it's like, I can clearly see a theme, but I'm not always sure. What do I make of it? So maybe we can talk about some of those. Before we get into that, you mentioned to me, I think when we finished recording last week, that you were going to be attending, I don't know if it was a web conference or a lecture?
Smithsonian Institute webinar, yes.
Okay, on Kubrick last week. So I'm curious, any particular interesting insights specifically towards Lyndon or Kubrick in general that enlightened you as somebody who already knows a lot about him?
I'm afraid that when the evaluation came along at the end, I was pretty snarky about the fact that I actually hadn't learned much. It was kind of a survey with clips that were not really clearly identified as demonstrating anything in particular. So I'm sorry to say, I don't want to sound arrogant, but it just kind of just reinforced things that I already knew. The one saving grace was at the end, there was a Q&A period. And so I asked the presenter if he could only preserve one Kubrick film for posterity, what would it be? And he kind of fudged it, and he said it would either be Paths of Glory or Strangelove, which I thought interesting because I would probably say Strangelove if I were choosing. Although I love it all. But anyway, so yeah, I didn't learn a lot. I thought I'd come into today's podcast with all kinds of inside information, but not only did I not learn anything, but he got a few things wrong that irritated me. So.
All right, well let's dive into the question that I want to talk about, which is what is this movie about? So what I'm going to do is present you some themes and make a case that these are themes, and then maybe we could think about A, is that actually a theme, and B, what does this movie have to say about it? Because what was interesting is I watched this with my wife and daughter, and like I said, they hadn't seen it before, and the takeaway when the film was over, I think my wife said, well, that was really interesting, but I'm not sure I liked it. But then the next morning, we had a really long conversation about it. So it was very clear. It's like, yeah, like the more you dig into this and think about it, it's like, it is really interesting. And there are lots of, again, I don't know that this is a movie that she would ever say she enjoyed or liked, but I definitely think the three of us had a good, we kept like pointing out, it's like, oh yeah, and then there's this too. What about this? What about this? So I feel like it was the beginning of this is a film maybe they may want to continue to unpack potentially. So I'm going to throw out a theme here and make a case that this is potentially a theme. So one theme, and this is not maybe the biggest, but there is definitely a theme running through this movie about fathers and sons.
Yes.
The opening shot of this movie, as you point out, we see Barry's father killed in a duel. Mm-hmm. So we never get to meet his father. He is dead, you know, as the narration begins, we learn this. So part one of the film is Barry really as a fatherless son. And he kind of runs through a series of maybe potential father figures in the first part of the movie. So you get, you get Grogan, who's his second at the duel and his captain. You also get his, I guess whoever the head of the Brady family is, has been serving sort of as a surrogate father to him. You don't really get much interaction with that, but Barry basically tries to blow up something that Brady is putting in place. You have Grogan, you have Potsdorf, you know, in the Prussian army. Yeah. Interestingly, Barry pulls both Grogan and Potsdorf's body out of danger in war. And then you get the Chevalier, who in the book is actually Barry's uncle. Huh. So there is this, because, in the movie, he is a fellow Irishman. In the book, this is his father's brother, which they end up, that's why his, the Chevalier's name is Bally Barry, like the Barry is from that same family.
Okay.
So that is yet another surrogate father. And then even when he encounters Captain Feeney, right, early in the film, that is a father-son, highwayman duo So we get that as a theme in the first part. And then the second half of the movie, Barry seems to no longer be searching for a father, but instead is a father to both Bullington and Brian. And we see the, in some ways we see Barry at his, we get a montage of Barry potentially at his best as a father, but also the various ways that he is unsuccessful as a father as well. So again, I don't have a large conclusion to make about this, but this definitely seems like something running through this movie.
So just a quick footnote on the Chevalier. The Chevalier is played by Patrick McGee, who is also in Clockwork Orange, and not to the same extent as Preston Sturges, but Kubrick did have kind of a little stable of recurring small parts. Philip Stone, who plays Graham, the accountant, he shows up as in The Shining as Grady.
Yes.
Anyway, so one thing, I mean, first of all, I agree with that pattern that you're pointing out, Sam, and maybe there's a connection to be made between a pattern and a theme, you know, and I think that what Kubrick is doing is he's creating a pattern of these father-son relationships, and I think he's creating a theme of Barry's, Barry is not, there are no characters in this film who are explored in any kind of a deep psychological way. You know, one of the things that's off-putting about this film for some people is it's a very deliberately surface-oriented film. And I think that's part of Kubrick's interest in exploring the 18th century, because one of the things he's trying to do in this film is he's trying to say, what happens if you take basically a painting and turn it into a moving picture? And I think he's doing quite a bit of that with the way he sets up these tableaus. But what does that have to do with father-son relationships? Well, because we don't get a lot of internal, you know, we don't get any kind of a voiceover from Barry. Ryan O'Neill isn't given a lot to say that reveals much of what's going on in his head. The narrator tends to tell us, but when it comes to his relationship with Grogan, with the Chevalier, with Brian, we see him shed genuine tears. We see moments of genuine emotion. And in fact, the narrator even sets up his emotion when he reveals himself to the Chevalier. In a way, he kind of accounts for Barry's emotions for us and even excuses him for what he's about to do. And of course, the other early role that Ryan O'Neill had was Love Story after starring in Peyton Place for 5 years. So if there's anything Ryan O'Neill can do, it's cry. So he's given a chance to express these emotions. So I think that's part of what Kubrick is doing, because I think his emotions over Brian are very deep. And the way he retells, I mean, this is another repetition. The film is full of repetitions, right? The way he retells the story of storming the castle as Brian is dying, it's very affecting. I mean, I think what he does in this film is, this film has very few emotional highlights, but the ones it has are really powerful. I think Brian's deathbed is very powerful. I think the moment in the duel when he refuses to kill Bullingdon is really powerful. So I think Kubrick is creating these surfaces, but then giving you these moments of emotion that enable you to kind of dive deeper.
Absolutely. So along with this being this at least pattern of fathers and sons, this is also a film filled with mothers.
Yes.
So you have at least three mothers in this movie. You have Barry's mother, who plays a very significant role, especially in the second half of the film. She's the one who, you know, if Barry shows himself to be this person kind of climbing social strata, whether intentionally or not, his mother is very strategic about it, you know, and she's the one who ends up running the house, and she's the one who makes the good point that, you know, that, that if you don't have a title, like everything you do depends on your wife. And if she tires of you or she dies, what happens to you and Brian? You have the German woman, who is also a mother, right? She's feeding her son. You have Lady Lyndon, who is a mother both to Bullington and Brian, and there is a lot about her relationship to her two sons.
Yep.
You also get, now Nora is not exactly a mother figure. She is, again, in the one of the strange things about this, and this, we brought this up when we talked about I, Tonya too, is like, The ages of people, like how old is Barry at the beginning of this movie? How old is he throughout this movie? In the book, when you're seeing Barry kind of try to court Nora, he's around 15 and she's around 25. Mm-hmm. So it is a much, I mean, they appear to be the same age, but she talks about him as if he's a boy and Quinn is a man. So there is this kind of separation there. So having the fathers and sons, and then also these mothers playing this interesting thing. Now I want to point out the opening line of the book says, since the days of Adam, there have hardly been a mischief done in the world, but a woman has been at the bottom of it. So that's Barry's opening line of the book. So it's interesting. Like, I don't think that's a theme of this movie necessarily, but in the book, again, Barry as an unreliable narrator, that's part of his read on the rise and fall of his life. So that made me look to the women in this movie a little bit and sort of think about, well, what role are they playing in his life?
I'm glad you brought up for I, Tanya, because you have another version of the kind of scheming but also highly competent mother in the case of his mother. I mean, I found it interesting because I didn't have any, in the first half of the film, I didn't have any sense of her as having that kind of character. You know, you only get a little bit of her. And then she shows up and she's been kind of transformed into, to allude to Vanity Fair, almost like a Becky Sharp character. You know, somebody who really knows how to take hold of a situation. And maybe it begins to suggest to you a little bit of how Barry came by some of his abilities, which, you know, you don't really know what Barry is capable of until he actually does it. And you're like, oh, I didn't know he was good at fisticuffs, or I didn't know he was such a rogue or a scoundrel. And you see a little bit of that maybe in his mother, because you don't know anything about his father.
Absolutely. So another big theme of this, and you brought this up, and I want to dig into this, is the idea of fate versus chance or will. Because as you pointed out, the film's narrator talks a lot about fate. He frames things that happen to Barry in terms of fate. It's also pointed out that he will sometimes reveal things that are going to happen before they happen, or the title cards do that. But when we were watching, you know, when you're seeing Brian pretty early on, the narrator basically says, well, Barry was fated to not have, you know, mm-hmm. any of his lineage live on. And it's quite a while before Brian gets injured and dies. But as I was watching with my family, when Brian starts talking about the horse, my wife yelled out, oh, Brian's going to die from the horse. I'm like, yeah, they told us he's going to die. Like, that's not a shock. So there is this sense of fate or destiny pushing this. At the same time, when you watch Barry, especially in the first half of the movie, making a lot of active choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he enlists in the army, right? He's not, I mean, he doesn't have a lot of options, but he, you see him watching that recruiter. The next thing you see is him in the army, and the recruiter's not forcing people into the army. It's recruiting people. So he chooses to be in the army. He chooses to desert the army. He chooses to join the Prussian army. I mean, he's sort of given this choice of like, well, you can join us or die. Again, not a great choice, but he makes that choice. He chooses to save Potsdorf. Everybody else leaves that burning building, and Barry stays, right? He makes an active choice. He chooses to take the job as a spy. He chooses to double cross his job as a spy. He chooses to pursue Lady Lyndon, right? When she gets up, he gets up to follow her. So is this a story of fate, or are we told this is a story of fate and Barry is actively making choices? I want to point to one other specific here to think about this. So I'm going to read what the narrator says, and then let's think about what we see. The narrator, this is after Grogan dies, when Barry's still in the British Army. The narrator says, but fate did not intend he should remain long an English soldier, and an accident occurred which took him out of the service in a rather singular manner. Now, what we see is Barry noticing an opportunity and taking it. I don't know if I think that's fate or that's Barry.
Yes. Well,
because if you just hear the narration, it sounds like something's going to happen to force his hand. Barry need not do what he does, but he sees an opportunity and he takes it.
Well, I guess, Sam, it's a double-sided coin. You know, from one perspective, the way that you told it, it's a series of chances, and Barry takes those chances. That's one way to read it. The other way to read it, the way the narrator is reading it, is it is fate which has placed him in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. And it's the classic determinism versus free will dilemma, right? Like, so yeah, is that his free choice, or is that the position in which he was placed? And he thinks he has a choice, but in fact, he really doesn't. And so I think that's part of what the film is about. Like, to what degree can Barry actually make choices? Because what's interesting is, okay, in contrast to all of those examples that you've given, which are very good examples, in contrast to all of those, when Barry deliberately sets out to do something, when he deliberately sets out to gain a title, he's unable to do it.
Well, because, and that's just it, yeah.
Because you can call it fate, or you can call it the structure of 18th century society. Those are not forces he can overcome. So I think that's the argument I would make, that what happened, that fate is playing the game all along. And when he really sets his mind on doing something, he's unable to do it.
Well, you just walked right into where I want to go next, because that's exactly it. As you get to the second half of the movie, the first half of the movie, it feels like there is this, you're getting two views, right? I mean, that I think the movie wants you to think about that. Because it wants you to get to the second half of the movie and say, is there a version of this where Barry does not reach his downfall? Like, is this, he was always intended to essentially return to where he began, maybe with some good stories and less leg, you know, is that just where his story has to go? Or is it Barry, is it choices, or is it systems, right? Mm-hmm. So I point out those places where Barry seems active to say, I like the tension between you're getting told something and shown something else, but that doesn't mean what you're told is wrong. It's just it's forcing you to say, which way are you reading this story? Because I think that second half, the first half of this movie is pretty fun.
Yes,
the second
yes.
half is less fun. And again, you're told from the title of part two, this is about the downfall of Barry Lyndon and how it all falls apart. So it's like, you know what you're about to see. And then you watch it and wonder, like, well, if he didn't seek a title, if he was nicer to Bullington, like, is there a way that he ingratiates himself? But maybe not. Maybe Bullington is going to dislike him, because he kind of does by definition. So there is no way, you know.
Well, okay. So I will insert a gloss on what you just said about, you know, could he be nicer to Bullington? One of the great 19th century novelists, George Eliot, said, "Character is destiny," which is another way of thinking about fate, right? So Barry, being who he is not capable of behaving differently to Bullington. So it's his own character, in a sense, which determines how he's going to act. And I have to say, Sam, the other thing I was thinking about as you were talking is that this is why I love a Kubrick film, because of the way it makes you work. It's a pleasurable work, right? But it makes you work to kind of try to figure these things out. And yeah, the first half is very picaresque. The first half is like this big canvas. And then the second half, it's like it becomes a chamber drama. And he shrinks it down to the domestic level. And you get suddenly, it's like you get two different Barrys. You know, the Barry at the top of his game, and then the Barry in that long, slow fall.
And he even gives you two names, right? Yes. You have Redmond Barry and Barry Lyndon, and those are different. Those are different beings in different settings. Now, to be fair to the phrase "character is fate," that is spoken by a novelist, so of course they're going to say that, right?
Yes. Think about that. You're right. The last time we see him named, she's writing the check, and he is Redmond Barry, right? Mm-hmm. So the implication is, you are born where you are, and you stay where you are. This is still in many ways, it's still a medieval view of society, where you just get slotted in where you're slotted in, and you're not going to be able to rise any higher.
Absolutely. And the only person in the second half who also calls him Redmond, so she calls him Redmond, and Bullington only refers to him as Redmond Barry, never refers to him as Barry Lyndon. So other huge theme, right, is about class distinction and wealth, because this is a movie about a guy attempting a social climbing, whether he's pulled into it by fate or does it by his actions. that's what this story, you know, ends up being about. So when it starts, we see Barry rejected by Nora's family, less because he's her cousin and more because he doesn't bring $1,500 a year like Quinn does. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love how their family is so, every time Quinn gets offended, they all circle the wagons and are like, no, 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 to the extent that they fake a duel to just get rid of Barry, to send those, like, we'll let Barry win just so we can get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And we can then, so I love the moment when Grogan says later, like, oh, you know, Nora ended up marrying John Quinn, and Barry said, there's another Captain Quinn. It's like, Barry, no, he didn't die. It's everything that they intended happened. But throughout the film, you see Barry climbing, mm-hmm. trying to climb the social structure, right? He is trying to attain and maintain the status of a gentleman. He tries to get honor in battle, right? Pulling Grogan off, pulling Potsdorf off. He tries to attain marriage, right? Because that's the way you do this. The narrator even says, like, this is not an atypical thing that Barry's doing, saying, okay, well, you reach a point in life where you marry for you marry for money. It's why I love the casting of Marissa Berenson here, because in the book, you don't get the sense that Lady Lyndon is any beauty. In the movie, it's like, let's cast a model there. So it's like, is Barry does not seem to be marrying for love or lust, even though, like, you look at her and, like, he could, like, you could do a lot worse than Marissa Berenson, right? As in terms of a beautiful wife, but that's not what he's after. He's after money. He's after status. Mm-hmm. And then you see him trying to attain a title, but all the while he is regularly put in his place in quotes by the people around him. So I love when after he saves Potsdorf, when he gets his reward, they make a speech about how terrible he is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very funny. It's like, we're going to give you this. You acted honorably, but your life is going to end poorly because of who you are. And it's just like, okay, so maybe this isn't the route to, which makes sense out of why the first chance he gets to get out of Prussia and go with the Chevalier, he's in on it. You know, he gives himself up as a spy right away because it's like, well, these are the same people who are telling me you're never going to amount to anything. They're just using me.
Well, at that moment in the film, it's a classic case of telling versus showing, because we haven't seen anything in Barry's behavior to suggest that he is reprehensible in any way. And yet that's just something they choose to label him with. So, you know, the narrator makes a couple of interesting comments after the wedding to Lady Lyndon. He says, Barry had now, and this goes along with our earlier comment, Barry had now arrived at the pitch of prosperity and by his own energy had raised himself to a higher sphere of society. But then he makes a comment, and I'm going to just paraphrase it. He makes a comment in the lines of, sometimes the qualities or the abilities that enable you to achieve a success are not the same that enable you to maintain it. And I think that the fact that Barry, you're right, he's after prosperity, but he's much more interested in the title. And that's, I mean, he spends money, he ruins the fortunes of the Lyndons. We never really learned to what degree they recover. But, you know, his investments are completely ruinous, because even if he loses all the money, what he really wants is that title. And so ultimately, that's the game that Barry is playing.
And here's what I love about what Kubrick's doing here, though. So we get this arc, right? We get Bullington, who from the very beginning talks about Barry as a usurper, right? Somebody who's an opportunist who's, you know, basically stealing his father's place and essentially potentially stealing his own place. You get others in English society who turn their back on Barry very quickly. But at the same time that people are saying, like, well, he's not, you know, he's from this lower background, all these things. It's like, if you watch the movie, who are these people who are critical of him? I mean, how are the rich nobility depicted in this film? Basically, we see them gambling, but not necessarily paying their debts. We see them sitting around listening to music, wearing ridiculous clothes and wigs and makeup, drinking, taking bribes, shopping for paintings, and then basically their main job seems to be writing checks for money that they didn't earn themselves. Like, who is Bullington? Bullington was born on third base, right? Like they're all critical of Barry of saying, like, you don't belong here. It's like, but what makes them belong here? And Kubrick does not depict them as living some particularly moral life, particularly, you know, that they are somehow better other than sort of the rules of the game, to quote another film, like, put them in this position and put them in a position to be critical of Barry saying, you don't belong here.
Well, that and that actually gets explicitly commented on when he goes to Hallam to ask him to, you know, assist him in gaining the title. Hallam says something. He says, well, the people that I support are the best. And then he starts to talk about how what he means by the best. He says, I don't mean they're the most virtuous or they're the most clever or they're the most. I mean, he names all these good qualities, and being the best has nothing to do with any of those. And the society itself kind of looks at that, takes a look at that, and is honest about its own hypocrisy or duplicity. To be the best simply means, for what, by whatever means you've gotten a title and a standing, that somehow makes you the best, but it has nothing to do with your character. And so I think that's a kind of vindication of Barry, that even though Barry cannot achieve that rank, What he ought to realize is the rank isn't worth achieving. The rank doesn't represent anything other than its own status. But Barry is so shaped by his society that that's the only way he can think. He can't think in terms of private virtue or in terms of any kind of moral qualities. He can only think in terms of the very limited view that society creates of what it means to be a person of worth and value.
I even love how even Lady Lyndon, like, you could think of her and be like, well, what is she like? We see her basically have an affair with Barry before her husband dies. So it's like, well, again, she can appear certain ways, but it's like, but if you're looking at her actions, it's like, I don't know. I don't know, like, what makes her better. So this actually made me feel like this movie oddly pairs really well with I, Tonya, to a certain degree, because I found myself saying, like, is this movie laughing with Barry, laughing at Barry? Is this pro or con when it comes to Barry?
That's a really interesting point. I think there are some people that say, well, you know, the narrator is there just to kind of diminish and comment on Barry to his disadvantage. And that's not really the case. And so I think there's a way in which, gets back to my earlier point, that even though he's not a psychologically complex character, he is a complex character in terms of how we respond to him. You know, if you were to kind of do, you know, your brief synopsis of who is this Barry Lyndon, I don't think you would be able to simply sum him up as, oh, he's just a rogue and a gambler and a no good Nick, because of the way he's historically and socially situated. I'm not saying that he is any way determined to be a rogue, but you can understand why he engages the behavior he engages because of the way the society has shaped him. So he ends up being very sympathetic as a result. But as with Tonya, you know, you can say, well, he's certainly responsible for this, but at the same time, look, you know, he hasn't been abused by his mother the way Tonya has been by hers, but he's been to a certain degree abused by society. And look at what they've created.
It's interesting. That's why I think about, like, when he and the Chevalier are, like, running their con, you're like, oh, but you're, like, you're cheating people, and why aren't they? So, like, that makes sense why they're not paying their debts and things like this. It's like, they are playing a rigged game while a rigged game is being played against them. It's like, it's all a con. I mean, like, you can step back and look at all of this and say, this is all just cons upon cons upon cons. What I find interesting about the movie is Barry is trying to play the game. So, like, when you talk about how he bankrupts the Lyndon estate trying to get a title, that's what he's told to do. His mother tells him, use money appropriately applied, we'll get you, we'll do wonders in the world. When he goes to the other nobles, like, the reason he's throwing these parties and paying these bribes and buying these paintings is because they're telling him, like, this is how you do it. This is how you get in good with people, right? And then the two noblest acts of this movie are not done by members of the aristocracy or the nobility. Mm-hmm. It is when Barry saves Potsdorf and when Barry doesn't shoot Bullington.
Yep.
Barry, at that point, Barry is like, oh, I get, like, I kind of get chivalry. I get what we're supposed to do here. Bullington's gun went off. He's the one who demands satisfaction. The appropriate, cultured, civilized thing to do is to point this gun at the ground and fire it. He has his satisfaction and we go on. And that's the thing that leads to his final, like the final insult to him is like, is him saying like, oh, I think I get the game now. This is what I'm supposed to do. And that's actually, it's like, nope, not for Barry, not for Barry.
Yeah. It's like Calvin Ball. You know, the rules just keep changing. You think, you know, the rules and they make up a new one. So you're right. So Potsdorf, his situation, yeah, he gets a monetary reward and then he gets told he's basically no good. And this one, as you said, he does exactly the chivalrous thing. And let me just say that in a film that is paced slowly, Kubrick slows it down to a complete crawl in that duel, and I think it's perfect.
Yes,
it's one
of the great scenes. It's
practically slow motion. But I think that's it's slow motion because that's where all the emotion is. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I just think it works beautifully.
So I think, you know, along the lines of this theme, there's a lot that rests on that final title card that says, you know, it was in the reign of King George III that the aforesaid personages lived and quarreled, good or bad, handsome or ugly, rich or poor, they are all equal now. Mm-hmm. You know, to say sort of death is the great leveler, right? Like all of these things and all of this climbing, you know, at one level you can say it's all meaningless, right? Because they're all dead now. What's interesting is this is a line from Thackeray.
Yep.
But this comes from very early in the book when he's talking about Barry's talking about his father's generation and how they're all dead now. This is not the conclusion to the book, but Kubrick says, ah, that's the idea. Let's put that at the end of the movie and switch it from King George II to King George III and say, this is the point. I love the ending of this movie.
And that, you know, and yes, you're right. Thackeray wrote that line, but he wrote it for Kubrick because I cannot think of a more appropriately Stanley Kubrick commentary on action than this. I just spent over three hours showing you all this. And you know what? It doesn't amount to anything because they're all dead.
Yes. I mean, another theme of this, which ties in with that, is the idea of like that this is a movie about a society where old brutality is masked in the veneer of civility.
Yes.
So the idea of the duels, right, as a way, I mean, it is trial by combat, but just dressed up with some rules. And as you say, the rules kind of change, like no two duels are ever the same. Duels can get rigged. I love the terror on people's faces when they're in the duels. Like there is nothing honorable or noble about this. These are people who are terrified with it's like the people who get to be the seconds to watch the duels. They get to be like, oh, this is a manly honor. You look at John Quinn's face and he, I assume, knows the duel is rigged and mm-hmm. he's terrified. Mm-hmm. You look at Bullington and he's out of his mind terrible. Leon Vitali is great in this movie. Yes. In that scene, like there is just such utter terror. Barry has less of that, but he has that as well. I mean, you have to dig deeper into Ryan O'Neill's eyes to see that a little bit, but the others just wear it, you know, out on, you know, kind of out in front. But it's interesting to think about, like, how does Quinn later in his life tell the story of his duel with Redmond Barry? How does Bullington tell the story of his duel with Redmond Barry later on? I'm sure it's not the way we saw it. I'm sure it gets played out in some way that elevates themselves.
But, you know, it's important in the society, Sam, that violence is ritualized and it's given this veneer of civilization, right? So, you know, the final break for Barry is his second fisticuff when he attacks Bullington in the drawing room. And, you know, so there's no fundamentally in terms of a duel as a way of dealing with a social insult, there's no fundamental difference between the insult that Barry has been given and the insult that Bullington has been given. Mm-hmm. And yet Bullington is enabled to exact his vengeance by going through this ritualistic duel in which he actually breaks the rules, and there's no implication that this is to his disadvantage. Whereas Barry expresses genuine emotion in the drawing room scene. And of course, I mean, I'm not going to excuse the violent attack, but it's quite clear that in this society, you can engage in violence only in ways which are socially sanctioned.
A perfect version of that is in the army at the beginning of the movie, when Barry starts, you know, when he gets insulted by the guy who then drinks his drink, and then Barry wants to fight him, and they're like, no, you guys can't fight unless we make a square, you guys can each other to a bloody pulp, because we are now in a square. You know, it's like that's, to me, that is a perfect metaphor for what this movie is like. That scene tells you everything about what this movie is about.
And Ryan O'Neal really was a Gold Gloves boxer, so he knew what he was doing.
You know, even if you think about the way that they go into war, right? You line up in your fancy uniforms and you just march. I mean, it's basically like duels on a large scale. Yeah. You just march at the other army as they fire at you, and you either get hit or you don't. You know, like it's baffling that as a, because it's not a strategy. It is just like, well, let's smash these two things together, and the one whose head falls off loses. Like, that's, you know, it's crazy. So I love the narrator when talking about this. I think this is when they show like the English army raiding a German farmhouse. Says, gentlemen may talk about the age of chivalry, but remember the plowmen, poachers, and pickpockets who they led.
Mm-hmm.
It is with these sad instruments that your great warriors and kings have done their murderous work in the world. So it is sort of like this is all the same old stuff, you know, but we're going to, if you put a coat on it and you march in a way, that's not, you know. Okay, one other thing. I can't believe we have not talked much about how this movie looks, but I just want
to... That was what I wanted to bring up.
So the other theme of this movie is a formal theme.
Yes.
Which is the reverse zoom.
Yeah.
It's not a move you see happen a lot in movies at all. And this movie does, it's countless times. You start on something close, a person, a conversation, an object, and you very slowly pull back unbroken to where that initial thing you looked at gets lost in this larger, beautiful painting. So, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, this is, it's interesting because it's the reverse action, but it's asking you to look closer, you know, to say, like, when you're walking through a museum and you're looking at these paintings and you see these people, these small little figures in the painting in the background, like, think about them, look at them. What's going on there? Right. So you're getting that reverse of like all of these small, sometimes mundane things or petty things, right, are part of this larger thing, which gets celebrated, romanticized, you know. And so I think, I mean, I, as a historian, I look at this and say, oh, this is about history, right? This is about what happens to history, how stories get told and forgotten, how things get romanticized and cleaned up and instead it's like, so he's starting on the focus tight and pulling back. And it's interesting, again, how many times in this movie that's what he does with the scene. It also makes a character, there's times where he does it with Barry, where Barry is the whole frame, and by the end, Barry's this tiny little thing in this much larger picture.
Which is an interesting counterpoint to the first image of the film, which is in fact shot at a great distance. And supposedly that shot was influenced by a scene from Howard Hughes's 1930 film, Hell's Angels. I have no idea if I haven't seen that film, but supposedly there's a duel in that film that Kubrick is kind of quoting.
Anything else you want to say about, I mean, this movie's famous for the use of natural lighting and all the technology they needed to use to, you know, to capture that. I mean, this is the epitome of the every frame a painting mantra. Like, if you pause this movie at any moment and said, if I had that up on my wall, that would be a beautiful work of art.
Yeah, well, you know, almost every Kubrick film, certainly from beginning with 2001, has some kind of technical innovation. So yes, the really big innovation here is the natural lighting by candlelight. And so Kubrick was able to adapt lenses that NASA had actually created for taking pictures on the moon. So these are among the lowest possible light that they're able to actually shoot by naturally. And that was important not only for the look of the film, but it meant that when they went into these locations where you have these objects that you can't expose to the bright typical lights typically used to light a set, They didn't have to worry about that because they used all this natural lighting. And of course, one of the four Academy Awards the film won was for the cinematography.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you think about like 2001 and you're like, well, this is a triumph of filmmaking technology because I'm seeing something I've never seen before. So is this like it's like you've never seen a film shot like this. You've never seen a scene on film that looks like this because you can't light a film the way they did this. And they had to come up with a way to like, it's stunning to watch like people talk, you know, in they're like when they're playing cards in a candlelit room, and you can actually imagine like, oh, this is what it must have been like when you walk through an old palace. Like I've been to Versailles and places like that. Like you can't imagine what must have this actually been like when people lived here. And it was like, that's like Kubrick is saying like, well, let me show you to the best of my ability, what that looked like.
And of course, you know, I talked earlier about Kubrick's kind of stable of supporters. So John Alcott, who gets the Oscar for cinematography, he shot Space Odyssey, he shot Clockwork Orange, he shot the Shining, and then Ken Adam, who gets the cinematography for art direction, he was the one who designed that fantastic set for Doctor Strangelove, mm-hmm. and another as well as for Barry Lyndon. So these are people that, you know, Kubrick has worked with a lot and really, really trusts. I want to say, out of all of the, I mean, you know, we could sit here all day and talk about all the great scenes, but I love, there's a shot of the Lyndon Castle through this gorgeous morning fog. Mm-hmm. And the narrator says something about the mist shrouded, about the legend that arose of his cruelty to his stepson. And the commentary is visual because the castle is shrouded in this mist. And it's like, well, maybe that's the perspective of the legend. Maybe it's, you know, it's very, very uncertain. So I just, yeah, you could look at some of these images all day without the story.
Well, Barrett, this has become a very long episode, but is there anything else you want to say about this movie that we didn't get to?
I just want one more thing. I want to go back to the closing date of 1789. Which aligns very much with the closing comment of the film, because 1789, and I think that throughout this film, Marissa Berenson, Lady Lyndon, looks a lot like Marie Antoinette. At the end, these people that have brought Barry down, they are going to get their comeuppance.
Absolutely. So I need to ask you this. You said Strangelove is the movie you would preserve if you could preserve one. Where does this rank among Kubrick movies? Now, and I will point out, in both the critics poll and director's poll in Sight and Sound, this is number two for them behind 2001. So 45 on the critics poll and 12 on the director's poll. So Barry Lyndon, although it was not successful in its time, at least commercially, and was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, is now regarded as, you know, towards the top of the vast Kubrick canon of masterpieces. So where do you put this?
I put it very high, and the reason I say Strangelove is because I think about what would I like to watch over and over. As much as I enjoy this film, I don't want to necessarily watch it over and over. I should also say, Sam, there's a pattern that Kubrick doesn't really have much box office, and even to a certain degree, critical success after Clockwork Orange. Almost all of his later films, the last half of his career from this film forward, almost all those films gain stature in retrospect. Like there's been a big movement in recent years to kind of say, well, let's go back and reevaluate Eyes Wide Shut. And that certainly happened with The Shining. For me personally, I was disappointed by The Shining when I first saw it in the theater, and it's grown to be one of my favorite films. So, but this one I'd certainly rank very high.
All right. So how do we follow this up, Barrett? What do you have for us for next week?
We do a complete change of tone and genre. So a friend of mine gave me this book by A.O. Scott called Better Living Through Criticism. And one of the movies that A.O. Scott really admires and keeps coming back to again in that book is Ratatouille.
Oh.
And I got an arc plan for the Ratatouille. So I want to go back to its 2007 Pixar Ratatouille next week.
Oh, fantastic. I did a Pixar podcast series with a couple of my nephews who are big Pixar fans, and this was at the top of our list of Pixar movies. So I'm very excited to revisit this. Barrett, thank you so much for recommending this film, for having this conversation. If you haven't seen Barry Lyndon, watch it. If you have, maybe revisit it. Like it stands up to to attention very well, I think. Like, paying attention to this movie, even if at first blush you're like, I'm not sure why I watched this or what that was, I think you keep I have notes we didn't get to of topics we could have talked about. We really didn't talk about what this movie looks like. There's so much you can say. So thank you for having this conversation and for recommending this movie. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back next week to talk about Ratatouille in the video store.